So welcome to our next installment of the Kollel Aharon Velea series. We are honoring the 26th yard site of my late Rosh Yeshiva, the head of Ner Yisrael in Baltimore, Harav Shmuel Yaakov Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Evracha. It's hard to believe it's been since 1999 that he passed away. I had the honor of actually learning with him one-on-one in the afternoon, which was kind of mind-bending. And he was considered one of the world's foremost Torah scholars, and it was a privilege to be part of his circle, and he's actually a member of my wife's family. I didn't know until after I met my wife, and it's kind of nice that I have that connection to him on both sides, both as a student of his and familially. So let us combine tonight two elements and see how they merge into one. The two elements are the Parsha, the Torah reading of this past Shabbat, which was Balak, the Parsha of Bilam, the wicked sorcerer, and the 70th day of Tammuz, the fast of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 70th of Tammuz, which was yesterday's fast. It's always nice to say fast yesterday. Fasts are so much easier when they're in the rearview mirror. It's an amazing phenomenon. So I'm going to weave the two together, and we're going to call it the Grand Illusion. Source number one. Let us look at the history, very briefly, if you will, of why we fast on the 70th day of Tammuz. So these, in no particular order, are the five reasons that historically we as the Jewish people fast. Number one. A, the tablets, the original Luchot Tabrit, were broken when Moses came down from the mountain as a response, of course, to the golden calf, to the Egel Hazaha. So that is the first reason given. Number two, B, the daily temple offering was canceled. They didn't have any more animals to bring in the morning and the afternoon for the constant sacrifices to God. Number C, very famous. The city walls of Jerusalem were breached during the destruction of the second temple. Interestingly, they were breached in the first temple 8 or 9 days earlier. And they used to fast on both days. But because we don't have the physical fortitude to have two fasts within a week of each other, let alone Tisha B'Av 3 weeks from now, they sort of merged the two fasts. So the fast of yesterday subsumes the fast for the original destruction of Solomon's temple. Number D, a wicked Roman ruler, Apostmus, burned the Torah. And then E, an idol was set up in the temple by the wicked ones of Israel, meaning Jewish kings, which caused our destruction and exile. So it's interesting, I heard Rabbi Baradowitz, my wife and I were listening to a very interesting class, and he talks about these five items. So again, the two that I think are the most famous reasons given for why we fast on the 70th day of Tammuz would be the tablets being broken by Moses, and then secondarily, the breach of the walls of Jerusalem, which ended 3 weeks later on the 9th of Av with the destruction of the temple. The other three are not quite as famous. So Rabbi Baradowitz talks about number D, that this wicked Roman ruler, Apostemus, burned the Torah. And he asks the following question, but a lot of Torahs have been burned over the millennia. We know that there were literally cartloads in the 13th century that were burned. One of the elegies that we read on Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, talks about this horrific thing where the bad guys took all these Torah scrolls and they burnt them in public. So one single Torah scroll being burned by a Roman ruler, Apostemus, it seems a little bit over the top that we would commemorate this with the fast day. We don't commemorate any other time that we burnt a Torah scroll with the fast day. So Rabbi Baradowitz cites a Jewish historian, a rabbi, who this rabbi doesn't have a source in this, but it's very intriguing. He says that in the time of the end of the Maccabean kings. So if you remember, Hanukkah began the rule of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees. Now, they were Kohanim, they were priests, but they also took hold of the kingship of Israel, which they had no right to. The kingship of Israel always belongs to Judah, Yehuda, not to the Levi. They took both, and it didn't end well. So he talks about these two brothers who were great, great, great descendants of the original Maccabees in the story of Hanukkah, and they were feuding for power of Israel. And one of the brothers made a huge, horrific, horrific mistake. He invited a Roman ruler to come in to Jerusalem to aid in his fight with his brother. So you have this Sinat Chinam, this baseless hatred between the two brothers, and one of the brothers makes the mistake of inviting the Roman ruler, and Rachel, will you help me with the Roman ruler? Pompey. Thank you. The evil Roman general, Pompey.
B-B-C-E.
Thank you. See, she knows it all. See, tada rava. In the year 63 before the Common Era, this brother, one of the two Maccabees, who's trying to be the ruler of Jerusalem, invites Pompey and the Romans to come to his aid. So Pompey figures, wait a minute. Hey, I could take the whole thing. I don't need these Jews helping me. Thank you for bringing me in. And Pompey goes ahead and he burns a Torah scroll. But he didn't literally burn a Torah scroll. Do you know what he did? He outlawed the learning of Torah. So they're describing the burning of the Torah, which is tantamount to the abandonment, the forced abandonment of the Torah learning by the Jews, by Pompey. So it was 133 years before the ultimate destruction of the Second Temple in the common year 70. So that's very interesting. So perhaps that is what number D is. Okay. Now, we speak of something called nested history. And I'm just going to touch this because it's a delightful idea. Sometimes, as history unfolds, we learn that disparate events that are not linked in real time, but in retrospect, we see the linkage. I like to call this nested history. If you were at one of my classes recently, I brought my wife, Rebetzin Ruchel's Matryoshka dolls, and we took them all out, remember, and we had them. And the last little bubalo is about that big, and you keep taking the dolls out. That's a beautiful example of how you have nested within history different elements. So nested within history is the following. Think about this. Chronologically, which of the first five events clearly happened the first? The destruction of the tablets by Moses as a response to the golden calf. So for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, the only import ascribed to the seventh day of Tammuz was, it was the day of Shvirat HaLuchot, that we broke the Ten Commandments. All of a sudden, hundreds of years pass. Oh my gosh, the Romans breached the walls of Jerusalem on the same day that the golden calf was built and Moses shattered the Luchot, the first tablets. Wow. So in retrospect, we see that the 2 days are linked and they were always thematically linked. Now, if you're God, it's not a problem. Because hu hayahu vavehiya, God was, is, and always will be. All of history is packaged together in one seamless flow. But for the rest of us, for the human element of the world, we only see things play out. And we look back, we say, oh my gosh, wait a minute. What a coincidence. The 70th day of Tammuz is the Roman day when they breached the wall of Jerusalem. Wow, we're already fasting on that day because of the loss of the original Torah when Moses shattered the Ten Commandments. Oh, and we stop, we say, wait a minute, wait, whoa, whoa, whoa. It can't be coincidence. It must be that these two items are interrelated, and they're very much interrelated, because the loss of the Ten Commandments was a belief in some fake imagery that we like to call the grand illusion, idolatry. Idolatry is the ultimate expression of chinam, something that is objectively false, a false god. It's a non-reality. Why do you think we lost the second temple? Because of chinam, baseless, non-objective hatred. So in other words, that word chinam, something that is a fake out, that it is illusory, that illusion destroyed that temple on the very same day that the illusion of the reality of the calf destroyed their first vision of the Torah. So they are linked. They have the same cause and effect. So therefore, by fasting, we're fasting for the same thematic element, chinam, a non-reality, a grand illusion. Only the 2 days are 1,000 years apart. So it's an amazing thing, because if you live in a world and you ask a little child today, well, why are we fasting on the seventh day of Tammuz? They'll say to you, temple, because we're still living in a diaspora. We haven't rebuilt that temple. It's very real to us right now, correct? However, predating the destruction of the second temple, had you asked a little boy or girl from Hebrew school, what's the fast of the seventh day of Tammuz? What would they say to you? Shattering of the tablets. So experientially for us, we're closer to the loss of the temple by far than we are to Mount Sinai. So therefore, in our human recollection, that is more immediate. I'm just sharing this with you, how fascinating it is to look at history and how there's this linkage that is not obvious at first experience, but in retrospect, in hindsight, you know, as they say in your little mirror, objects may be closer than they appear. And by the way, as a little humorous anecdote, does anyone remember the gazillion-dollar Hubble telescope? Do you remember that? I think it's still flying out there, taking these amazing... So do you remember they had major issues with the Hubble when it first went? They had some real design issues. It wasn't quite working. So the funny thing is, the people who built the Hubble are the same people who couldn't get your car mirror close enough to see that the objects may be nearer than they appear in your mirror. Somebody said, you know, if they can't quite get that mirror in the right perspective, I'm not sure they should be building the gazillion-dollar Hubble to see all of Genesis and the Big Bang. That was just a little side note. So objects are more important in the mirror as they gain on us, as they catch up with us, and we catch up with them. So now, you may be asking, okay, Rabbi, you laid out the history of the 70th day of Tammuz. We now understand there's this duality to the day. It's both the Ten Commandments being shattered at Sinai, the golden calf, and equally true, it's also the breach of the walls of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple. They're both true. So how does that relate to the Parsha from Saturday, Balak? That's a great question. Let's go there, shall we? Have a look at source number 2. So after God congratulates Moses for shattering the tablets and taking retribution against those who perpetrated the crime of the Jewish history, God says, you know, Moses, I will not destroy the Jewish people. I hear you. Moses prays like he's never prayed before, and God acquiesces to Moses' amazing prayers. And God even teaches Moses, you know, in the future when the Jews will mess up, I'm going to give you the Yud Gimel Midot Sharachamim. I'm going to teach you the magic words that when you Jews are going to mess up in the future, use those words and I'll give you a pass on your crimes. And of course, Hashem, Hashem, Kerachum, V'chanun, Erech HaPayim, we sing it with lots of hope in our hearts on Yom Kippur, on the days leading up to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, right? So this is the response of God to the crime, the unthinkable crime of the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. On the day, God says, that I take account, etc., etc. So what does God say? As for now, I shall listen to you, Moses, and refrain from destroying them all at once, but always and consistently. Whenever I will take an accounting of their sins, means our sins, I will also account for a little of this sin along with their other sins. And indeed, no punishment is meted out to Israel that does not have along with it some of the punishment of the sin of the calf. So listen to this. It's an amazing idea. So if we were deserving of absolute nuclear annihilation at Mount Sinai, God said, I will dole it out to you generationally. And rather than have the nuclear option, which Moses prayed to, please don't do this to the Jews, God said, fine, what I will do, it's going to be a very long-term installment plan. And every time the Jews collectively as a nation sin, miktsat, a tiny snippet of the original nuclear option will be given at the time of each sin generationally. And because it was over thousands of years, it was survivable. We were able to survive as a nation. So what that means is that whenever we are punished, even now, ad hayom hazeh, until this very day right now, a little miktsat, a little snippet of that punishment comes back from the egel hazeh, from the golden calf. Now, why is that germane? Because Bilam, the wicked sorcerer, tried to use this fact on the ground that there was the potential of the golden calf being the nuclear option for the Jews. And as you will see, he's going to utilize that nuclear option in a failed attempt, if not for God's good graces, to destroy the Jewish people. So now let's get to the greatest villain in all of villainy, Bilam. If any of you are Star Wars fans, do you remember the evil Emperor Palpatine? So he's designed on the character, I believe, of Bilam. He even looks like I would picture Bilam. Okay? And he has the same nefarious dark source powers of Bilam. In fact, the rabbis compare Bilam to a bat. Whereas Moses, his prophetic ability, he was like an eagle who sees the light, the goodness of the world. But in nighttime, an eagle is blind. A bat with its sonar sees brilliantly only in the darkness. And so Bilam's koach, his strength, his ability to curse, his eye allowed him to have vision only in choshech, in the darkness of our world, meaning in the evil of our world, in the parts that we won't go there. And that was Bilam's unique strength. But it's more than that. Have a look at source number three. The Torah ends, literally, two verses from the end of our Bible, of our Torah, with a shout out to the uniqueness and greatness of this character, Bilam. So everyone says, wait a minute, Rabbi, Bilam, Shrek's talking donkey, and he was a failed curser. He didn't even, instead of cursing the Jews, he ends up giving us a great bracha. Three great, terrific blessings. Yeah? Okay, that's true. But for the Torah to end with an homage and a shout out to the great Bilam, the potentiality of who he could have been in another world, perhaps, that means he's a very serious character. God takes him very seriously, as you will see. So look at source number three. And there was no other prophet who arose in Israel like Moses. That's the end of the Torah, except for a couple lines. Now, what does it say in the Midrash, in the oral tradition? Among Israel, there was no one who ever arose as great as Moses. But there was one who arose among the nations of the world. Why would this be so? This was so that the nations of the world would not have an excuse to say, ha, had we had a prophet like Moses, we too would have served God. And who was this prophet like Moses that the nations of the world were given? This was Bilam ben Beor, Bilam the son of Beor. And by the way, he is an actual real historical person. They found, I think I've mentioned this to you before, but you can Google this after the class. Trust me, but verify. Okay? We say in Hebrew, we say, Kavdehu v'chashdehu. If you know your Hebrew, you'll know what I just said. Honor him, but be a little suspicious. Check the facts. So here's the fact. They found an amulet, and it was carbon dated to the time when this Bilam would have lived. And the amulet is a very positive portrayal of Bilam. It mentions Bilam ben Beor by name. It's all written in like an ancient Aramaic. What else would he have spoken? And it's a curse, which is hysterical because when he lost his prophetic abilities, Bilam became kind of like a sorcerer for hire. So somebody hired him to curse someone's husband's male parts. I guess he was not being a very good husband. So some woman hired Bilam, and there's an actual curse that Bilam tries to inflict on some guy's male privates. And it's written on an amulet. And if you ever, I don't recommend you go to Jordan, but if you ever go to Amman, Jordan, they have a museum there, and this amulet is proudly on display. So Bilam ben Baor has been carbon dated to when he would have lived, which is kind of hysterical. Okay, let's carry on. So Bilam is this incredible character who is the Moses of the nations of the world. And I know that he didn't quite succeed, but he could have been a contender, right? He could have been someone. So have a look at source 4. We are now going to get to the Talmudic power of Bilam. And it's kind of frightening, but it's a little strange. So here is what the Talmud says. You ready? Follow with me, number 4. Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Yossi, how do you know that we must not try to appease a man in the time of his anger? For it is written, my face will go and I will give you rest. God, the Holy One, blessed be he, said to Moses, wait until my countenance of anger has passed, and then I shall give you rest. But then Talmud says, what? But is anger then a mood of God? He gets angry? Talmud says, yeah, he does get angry. What? For it has been taught in a Braita, which is like a Mishnah, Torah, Shebaal Peh, oral tradition. God is angry every day. Kel zoeh b'chol yom. Now the good news is, how long does God's anger last? A moment, a rega. And how long is this moment? You'll love this one. 158,888 part of an hour. This is a moment. Wow, kind of short. By the way, it's a variable moment. So every 24 hours, that little 50th of a second, kaboom, varies its timing. Wow. And I love the word creature here. Doesn't say human being. No creature has ever been able to fix precisely this moment, except who else? The wicked Bilam, of whom it is written, he knows the mind of the Most High. But Thomas says, wait a minute. He knows the mind of God? Wait a minute. He did not even know the mind of his animal, his talking donkey. How then could Bilam know the mind of God? Thomas says, well, it doesn't mean he really knows the mind of God. The meaning is, therefore, only that he knew, Bilam did, how to fix precisely the exact moment in which the Holy One, blessed is he, is angry. And this is just what the prophet Micha said to Israel. It was from yesterday's Haftorah, from the Haftorah on Saturday. My people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, devised, and what Bilam, the son of Beor, answered him, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. What does it mean that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord? Rabbi Eliezer says, God, the Holy One, blessed is he, said to Israel, see now how many righteous acts I performed for you in not being angry in the days of the wicked Bilam, for had I been angry, not one remnant would have been left of the enemies of Israel. And this too is the meaning of what Bilam said to Balak. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I anger when the Lord has not become angry? This teaches us that he, God, was not angry all these days that Bilam was looking to curse the Jews. And by the way, how long does his anger last? One moment. How long is this moment? Rabbi Avin, and some say Rabbi Avina, says, as long as it takes to say the word, rega, moment. And how do you know that he is angry for one moment? For it is said, for his anger is but for a moment, ki rega ba'apo chayim birtsono. His favor lasts a lifetime. All right, let's unpackage this Talmud. I did a lot of reading. So listen to this. Bilam knew how to curse, but he didn't actually have special powers except for one. In addition to being the Navi, the prophet, he knew how to calculate this one rega, this one little moment in time, every 24 hours, where apparently the Lord gets angry. And he's not specifically angry at the Jews. He's angry at the world. We have to understand, what would that mean? I mean, God has a mood? I mean, God, you're God. If you get angry, just go like, new countenance, and now I'm happy. Right? He's God. He can do anything. He's not a human being. Why are we ascribing human character traits to God. What does that mean even? But Bilaam apparently could somehow intuit the time when God was angry. What if you knew when that moment was? And let's say you directed your one eye, which is all Bilaam had, the eye of justice, towards someone or some entity deserving a punishment, and you said, God, punish them. God would essentially look at that person, those people, and blow them up if, in fact, they were deserving of judgment and execution. So what is this all about? So let's talk about creation. So in Genesis, there are two reports of Genesis. Report one, Breshit bara Elohim. God as judge creates the heavens and the earth. Then there's a second report. The second report is that Hashem Elohim, God, judgment, and mercy creates the heaven and the earth. Why two accounts? So the rabbis say, because God saw that if it's just the Genesis creation with pure judgment, the world could not exist. Nobody, no people on earth, no creatures on earth could withstand the scrutiny of pure righteous judgment. Now, what does that mean, righteous judgment? It means there's no Yom Kippur. There's no Chatanu, we sinned, please forgive me. It means that when a person sins, that lightning bolt is instantaneous and the world would cease to exist. So God could not have that. So God, he didn't change his plan, but he simply modified and said, I'm going to balance justice with mercy. So we have both parts. Rosh Hashanah, the new year, we always say the Yom HaDin, the day of judgment. But then 10 days later, you're held over for mercy, which is Yom HaKippurim, the day of atonement. The two balance each other, correct? Now, every 24 hours, there is one nanosecond in time where God, by definition, has to treat the world with the original vision of pure judgment. Din, pure judgment. But happily for us, Baruch Hashem, thank God, that second is not even a second. It's a moment. And then the rest of the 23 hours, 59 minutes, 59 seconds plus, we're good to go. But if a person could calculate, like Bilaam, when that little nanosecond was, and if you knew a couple good four-letter words, Bilaam knew a couple, and you could curse someone during that moment, and they were deserving of the curse. In other words, you can't just throw someone's name out. It just means that God's going to scrutinize them for judgment. If they are deserving of punishment, kaboom. If they're righteous, then nothing happens to them. So what did Bilaam do? Bilaam was a master of finding every single human being's weakness. How did he do that? Because he says, I'm the man of one eye. Ish shesum ha'ayin. I have the closed eye. Some say that he, I don't want to get too graphic here, but he carved out his own eye. So he only had one eye. The eye he kept was an eye of din. God gave us two eyes, and this is very mikubal, Kabbalistic. It's very mystical. But the two eyes, one is to see the world with judgment, the other with mercy, that the two balance each other. Think about it. If you only have one eye, what are you lacking? Depth perception. No matter how great your one eye is, you can ask Moshe Dayan. No matter how great your one eye is, without the other eye, you lack a certain lack of perception of depth. It's too bad that Dr. Frank is not here. I would have asked him to explain this, the science behind it.
But eyes are coming at different levels.
Correct. Yeah. Exact. Thank you, Doc. So that depth is lacking. So Bilaam proudly got rid of the merciful eye, and he would see the world through scrutiny, through judgment. Now, what else did he do? So listen to this. He, Bilaam, had an ability to find a person or a nation's weakness. And he would use that weakness, and then in that moment of judgment, he would take a little snapshot. Pretend he is a, do you know what paparazzi are? Do you remember them? if you're the Queen of England and you're Charles and Diana, you unfortunately know what paparazzi are. They're the guys with the big speedwinder lenses. Rachel and I saw some guy in the, remember the bird sanctuary? And I asked him how his Nikon was. You know, he had like a lens about yay long with a speed loader. You can just push the button down and it takes like 1,000 pictures per minute, you know. And that's what they would do. They would sit opposite Buckingham Palace, you know, like on a tree, and they would try to get a picture that they could then sell to the National Intruder magazine or whatever at your supermarket checkout. They get a picture they would sell for $1,000 of the Queen or Charles or some famous, you know, one of your famous Hollywood actors going out jogging without makeup, right? Paparazzi get those pictures. They follow famous people around taking pictures. That's what Bilam did. If you look at the story, what does he do? Three times he goes up to mountaintops overlooking the Jewish people. It's almost like he's taking out his Nikon camera with his magnified lens and his speedwinder, and he's looking for an opportunity to cast his evil eye, his eye of judgment on the Jews. The third time he goes up, look at source 5. This is the last time that Bilam attempts to destroy the Jews. And this is where he doesn't use sorcery. He uses his own power. Listen to what it says. Bilam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel. So he did not go in search of omens as he had done time and time again. He turned his face towards the desert. Bilam raised his eyes and saw Israel dwelling according to its tribes, and the Spirit of God rested upon him. And then, of course, what does he say? Ma tovu alecha Yaakov mishkan asecha Yisrael. How goodly are your tents, Israel. Beautiful, the Jews are the best. Because God put those words in his mouth. So instead of a klala, a curse, he gives us a blessing for all ages. But why did he turn his face towards the desert? Do you want to take a guess? Because of the crime of history that occurred in the desert. You know what he did? He took out his Nikon and he turned his one eye towards the desert. And he took a little snapshot in his mind's eye of the Jews dancing, cavorting with their licentious behavior around the golden calf. That was Shiva Sarba Tammuz. He's using it. He's using that, I will hold you account forever and ever. The punishment will be doled out generationally. Bilam is tapping into that first source that we had to destroy the Jews. In other words, what does he want to do? He wants to take a snapshot of us. And in that nanosecond, he's going to present before God in that nanosecond of pure righteous judgment. Oh, you like the Jews, God? What do you think of them now? And he's going to show us cavorting in front of the golden calf, hoping that what will God's response be? Nuclear option. Kaboom. Only what did God not do? He withheld that nanosecond of judgment from Bilam. And instead of coming back with a nuclear option, he gives us a great bracha. He gives us an incredible blessing. So I want you to think about this. What I just described for you is what is going on in our world right now. It is what Hamas, Iran, speaking of nuclear options, and what the enemies of the Jewish people have been waiting to do. It's what the Nazis did to us before they burned us in Auschwitz. It is Bilam. Now, how do I know this? Because this is what it means to look at a world through the scrutiny of a Bilam's one eye. In other words, think about what the world does. Hamas, with incredible cynicism, built an underground infrastructure, right? They spent billions of dollars with the tunnels. And if you ask anyone who is somewhat knowledgeable about urban warfare, they would tell you ahead of Israel going into Gaza, you can't go into Gaza. It's impossible. Because they're built under hospital structures, day schools, daycares, mosques. The Jews are moral. We are the people of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You can't fight this war. You can't win this war. It's a very cynical move, meaning you will wipe us out, rape and pillage us on October 7th, take hundreds of our people back into the subterranean labyrinth that you have created over the last 20 years, and you know that if Israel's going to fight a war, Israel will lose its noble status among the nations of the world. We have lost that noble status because Israel had to make a very big choice. Do we wish to lose our noble status as the light to the nations? Or do we wish to lose our lives as a nation? Do we want dead Jews all over the world, all over Israel? Or will we fight at the great cost of losing some of our love and image and morality? But I promise you, this is by design. So what does the world do? I want you to think about this, the cynicism here. On October the 8th, Israel had not even accounted for the dead and the living. There was already, and you can look this up on Google, there was already a major rally, a protest in Times Square. And they were displaying swastikas on their iPhones. Death to the Jews. I'm not really sure how those placards, beautifully manufactured and professionally done, just coincidentally, were all waiting on October 8th to be held up against the Israel. Now, remember, at that point, there hadn't been an invasion of Israel and Gaza. That war won't happen for weeks. So what exactly were they protesting? They were using the Bilam technique. So what does Bilam do? Bilam doesn't look at October 7th. It's not important anymore. Just look at a dead baby in Gaza as a result of collateral damage, which no Jew and no Israeli would be proud of. They are mournful of. It is destructive to the soul of the Jewish soldier. But what do they do? Bilam looks in the moment. And when you look in the moment, there's no 1 second earlier and there's no 1 second later. Because as you know, when I take a picture, pictures don't lie. So what Bilam did and what our world does is they take a little snapshot of Israel. Do they care about the history, about the Holocaust, 1947-40? No, it's not relevant. Do they care about what's going to happen a moment from now? No, it's not relevant. Just take in and digest the horror of the snapshot of the picture. Do you like what you see? And if you don't, what are you going to do about it? You're going to protest against Israel? Globalize the Intifada, whatever the new monikers are? This is the nature of Bilam. This is what Bilam does. He decontextualizes the world. He takes the reality of the truth of a situation, takes a little picture. Now remember, how long is the moment of wrath? It's a nanosecond, yeah? And we know in that nanosecond, if you present one picture as an ultimate truth, representative of a holistic truth, people are dumb enough and naive enough to buy into it. And it's horrible. The difference between, think about it, a picture of someone who is defending human life and someone who is an overt first-degree murderer is only the context of what you see. In other words, if all you are privy to is someone with a gun shooting another person, and you're not privy to the 10 seconds before the gunshot, and you don't see the home invasion and the person with the gun and the knives coming to attack the man's family, but you only see stripped out of all context the person killing the individual, and you don't know what you're even looking at because you're not seeing what was and what will be. That is what the Rega is. This is the power of Bilam. So we live in a world right now, right this second, where Bilam is triumphing over the Jewish people. We are losing this battle. Hamas and its willing participants and the people who are not just willing, but they're being funded with millions and millions and millions of dollars coming from very bad sources all over the world. It's by design. And it's by design to destroy the Jewish people. They are using the technique right from our Parsha, what Bilam did. So you might say, what is the answer? It's only one answer. The answer is to either ask God to protect the Jewish people from the scrutiny of the Bilams of the world. So we pray for that. But on the other hand, it's up to us to supply the missing context. So before we scrutinize somebody with the evil eye, open up the eye of rachamim, the eye of mercy. So perhaps if we will start ourselves in our own interpersonal relationships, this three-week period that began last night and culminates with the destruction of the temple is the perfect time to repair the damage that baseless hatred did that caused the destruction of the Jewish temples. We've never rebuilt those temples. You know why? Because apparently we haven't solved the riddle of how to be better at interpersonal relationships. And perhaps if we will look at each other with depth perception, with both eyes, and rather than rushing to judge the person with that eye, which is the eye of judgment, the eye of Bilam, if we will balance that eye with the eye of Rachamim, of mercy, to give the benefit of the doubt to that person, to not rush to judgment on that person. If we will not just take one snapshot, but look at a series, say, oh, before I judge, I want to see a video of your life. I want to see what happened before. I want to see that couple hours of your life afterwards. And then and only then, after you talk with the person and get to know the person, then you can understand how many times in your own lives have you experienced relationships where you rush to judgment, and then in retrospect, you say, oh my gosh, how was I to know? That's the point, we don't know. So my prayer for all of us is that with us, on a small local level, if we will begin to use both eyes, use the Bilam eye very sparingly, but before you go to that option, please take out the Rachamim eye, the mercy eye, and use that eye. And with the depth perception that both eyes give us, please God, we should all increase our relationships and the beauty of our relationships, our communal efforts. And in that schud, in that merit, may God protect us and all the Jewish people here and abroad, and especially Achenu Beit Yisrael Be'eretz Yisrael, our brothers and sisters Israel, who are living under that eye of Bilam and the world. It's time to step up. And if we can do better, then God willing, God will protect us from Bilam's eye.